Welcome to Radio Curious. I'm attorney Barry Vogel. In this, the second of two Radio Curious interviews with Gregory Cochran, an aerospace physicist and anthropologist who co-authored the book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Behavior, we continue to explore how humans appear to have evolved over the last 10,000 years. In our conversation, we discuss how gene mutations have allowed specific human advantages in different locations around the world, skull size and skin color, for example. I spoke with Gregory Cochran from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico on February 23, 2009. We continued our conversation about the concept of a book that he recommended in our first interview, The Twilight of the Mammoths, Ice Age Extinctions and the Rewilding of America, by Paul S. Martin. This book explores why many of the very large mammals became extinct as humans populated their habitat.
There's a book I finished just about a week ago, which touches upon something I mentioned in this. It's a book called Twilight of the Mammoths, by Paul S. Martin, and it talks about the extinctions of the large animals that used to live in places like North America and South America. As I said, there were mammoths, there were mastodons, there were giant ground sloths, some of them heavier than an African elephant. There were different kinds of bears, there were saber-toothed tigers, there were animals very closely related to the African lion, all of those things. In North America, there was at least as much big, wild, and dangerous game as there is in Africa today. And in South Africa, in South America, they had even more. But then it all disappeared over about 1,000 years. Now, Paul Martin is the guy who developed the idea that this is largely a consequence of, you know, when early American Indians first show up, first managed to get past the ice and into North America, you have people who are very professional hunters. I mean, they had to have lived up in the Arctic. And they've run into a world in which animals that don't even know that people are scary. You know, animals that would let you walk up to them, you know, which is typical when you have animals that have never seen, or say penguins or something that have never seen people, they're not afraid.
Like we find in the Galapagos Islands.
Same thing there. Right. Think of it as a 1,000-year barbecue. And he's been making the case, and I think it's a good case, that, you know, this is what happened when really talented, skilled human hunters run into completely naive animals. In Africa, it was different. You know, people are slowly developing better skills, but the animals can actually adapt. You know, they at least learn to be afraid of humans, if nothing else, and maybe have some other defenses. But in a number of places, when modern humans show up, the large animals particularly, since they're the most worth hunting, they disappear quickly. This happened first in Australia, where there used to be some large marsupials. There was a wombat the size of a hippo, all gone. That was about 50,000 years ago. The next was the Americas, which is about 10, 11,000 years ago. And then later, it's happened on places like New Zealand, where the moa, you know, the very large flightless birds, disappeared within about 100 years of the first time Polynesians had landed there. And also Madagascar, which also had some large flightless birds and other animals. They had a lemur the size of a gorilla. Not anymore.
And they disappeared because they were taken for food?
Most of them. I mean, some of these things disappeared, like probably the predators. Like, I would imagine that the reason the saber-toothed tiger disappeared was because, you know, humans were hunting its prey rather than deliberately hunting saber-toothed tigers, because that strikes me as kind of a hazardous hobby. But if you get rid of the things it lives off of, you get rid of it, too. It's also possible that humans sometimes reshape the landscape by setting fires and things, sometimes deliberately, because a lot of places you'll get more game. You'll get more production if you burn down trees and have prairie instead. I mean, primitive hunters knew this and sometimes did it deliberately. I think in Australia it's called fire stick farming. So other things people did other than just hunting may also have influenced it, but probably hunting was the main thing.
Well, let's stay with our species for a little bit and talk about the genetic changes that result in different hues in skin color.
Well, this is one we now know a fair amount about it. Fairly recently, we probably learned almost all of this in the last 3 years. We now know that it's a complex system that gives you dark skin to protect against ultraviolet rays and other things. And then among people, and originally, all humans have this version because all humans appear to have lived in Africa, let's say a little before 50,000 years ago, all modern humans. And as they expanded, they moved into places where the conditions were different. Europe, for example, or North Asia. And what happened is that for some reason, and we have reasonable guesses, but we don't know for sure, it was actually advantageous to be paler in these places. It's quite possible that being pale paid off in terms of letting you get more vitamin D, since you get vitamin D from sunlight hitting your skin. And there is less, there's less ultraviolet, the type of sunlight you need in these places. It may mean you needed a paler skin. There's other possibilities too, but this is probably the main hypothesis for why. And so what you had was, you know, mutated versions of some of the genes that are involved in this system that makes dark pigment for the skin occurred and then became common with fairly rapidly. One of them appears to also give you blue eyes. It makes your skin somewhat lighter and it makes your eyes blue. That one appears to be less than 10,000 years old. It spread to become common in some parts of Europe. But if you go, you know, to Asia or Africa, you know, you won't find it. We know about 5 or 6 genes like this in Europe, which together probably are most of the explanation for light skin in Europe. And most of them appear to have changed fairly recently, certainly after people moved out of Africa, and some of them in less than 10,000 years. Now, in China, North China, people have fairly light skin, but they have achieved it in a completely different way.
What is the difference?
Different mutations, and often different genes have changed.
But originally for the same result, so that more vitamin D could reach the body.
Possibly, but there are other possibilities. I mean, let's suppose that you have a gene that is involved in the system of making melanin, but it does something else as well. Many genes have more than one function. Now, it might be that in the past, that gene really couldn't change because it had to do things in a certain way to produce melanin, by the way, if you don't have enough melanin and you live in the tropics, you're in deep trouble. You'll get skin cancer and other problems. But it might be that made it hard to improve that second function because it was, you know, very constrained by what it had to do in the melanin pathway. So if once you're living, let's say in Ireland, someplace cool and misty with very little ultraviolet, it might be that gene is now free to change in some way that improves that second function, whatever it is. It might also give you vitamin D. It might even give you advantage two ways. But that there's at least a possibility that there are other things that are changing. You know, there's other ways in which this pays off other than just vitamin D. One of the reasons I sort of suspect this is because often the genes that mutated are just different in China and Europe. And you'd think that if all you had to do was knock out that gene to get an advantage, you'd think that it would happen both places, because there's a lot of different ways to knock out a gene. But I could be wrong.
As further understanding of DNA reveals itself, do you foresee answers to these questions as to why?
Eventually, although some of them may be tricky. I mean, it's going to be particularly tricky if this was an advantage that just doesn't exist at all anymore. Like, for example, what if there was a disease running around in Europe 10,000 years ago, one that is not there anymore, and a certain mutation protected you against it and became common, and maybe is still common? But if the disease is not there, it's going to be kind of tricky figuring it out. I can tell you one example, which probably is like that. People have recently noticed that they're starting to see black wolves in places like Canada. And wolves used to never be black. And what it turns out is there's a mutated gene which they had picked up from dogs, but somehow it works very well, and it spread much more than typical dog genes have among wolves. And this gene gives them dark fur, but by looking at the biochemistry, there's a strong suspicion this gene is involved in protecting against some disease because it affects the immune system as well as skin color. I mean, a coat color. So, you know, if this happened far enough in the past and the the world has simply changed, we might have trouble figuring out. But I think we'll probably figure out most of it.
You also make reference in your book, The 10,000-Year Explosion, to the change in the size of skulls of people who lived in England.
Well, that one's interesting. There are sort of two things here. One is, over the longer period, human skulls have shrunk. Say, they probably reached their biggest, something like 15,000 years ago, just before the end of the Ice Age. And since then, they've shrunk in almost every population, maybe not every population, by something like 10%. You know, the skull has shrunk. This is good evidence that change is happening. It doesn't tell you exactly why, but there's no doubt that the change has happened. But there's reason to think that this change has continued. For example, there are skull features which today are very rare in Europe, but they weren't so rare 3,000 years ago.
What are those features?
Well, brow ridges, for example, sort of, you know, strong, you know, sort of a little bump of bone, you know, more than a little over the eyes. Australian Aborigines still have this, but it used to be, you know, 3,000 years ago it was moderately, you know, maybe 10% or 5% of Europeans had it. 20,000 years ago, a lot of Europeans had it. It's almost gone now. It's decreased somewhat in Australia, but the point is these things have changed. But the one you mentioned, there's some indication that this change may have continued even in the last 1,000 years. When people were comparing skulls of people who died back in the Black Death with skulls today, their shape is somewhat different.
What would be the cause of this change? Would that be sexual selection within an island population or something else?
Well, this change is not just in England. I mean, it's happened in, you know, if you look for skulls that are sort of 4,000 or 5,000 years old, they're sturdier, they're heavier, they're a bit different in Germany as well, and other places where people have looked. Could it be sexual selection, which is to say, is this, sometimes you could have something, you know, if women like a given thing or men like a given thing, could you eventually get more of it? I said, it's possible. But it's also, but some of these things, the fact that it happens everywhere in the world starting 10,000 years ago makes me think it's not sexual selection, it's something else. Maybe it's temperature. I mean, the world got warmer, and there is a general tendency for brains to be larger in the coolest parts of the world, in populations that have lived there a long time. Eskimos have pretty large brains for their size compared to other people.
Is there an understanding as to why?
Probably not entirely. I'd say there is some ideas. I wouldn't call it understanding. One reason is probably because, you know, there are some problems with, you know, if you get too hot, for example, you will get a heat stroke or something, and the brain generates a lot of energy, you know, uses a lot of energy and therefore generates a lot of heat. It may be that you need to worry about this less in a cool climate, which is, in other words, it might, all else equal, it might be sort of an advantage to have a bigger brain. If you could do that without having to worry about getting too hot, maybe that's why, but I'm not sure why. But it's a known trend.
Well, there are a couple of variables in there. One would be the size of the infant being born. Could it pass through the birth canal?
That's a difficulty, certainly.
And another is intelligence. It seems to be that the larger the brain, the greater capacity for intelligence.
That is the case, although it is not super simple. I mean, for example, suppose you look at IQ scores and brain sizes in humans today, you'll find there is a correlation. But it isn't one-to-one. I mean, it's not automatically true that somebody's smarter who has a larger brain. There's a general tendency that way. There's a correlation that probably explains about a fifth or something of the variation we see in IQ. So, I mean, it matters, but it's not the whole story. I mean, there's other things. It may be that the speed of nervous propagation, the way in which the brain is organized, the extent of connection. I mean, there's a lot of other things that might vary. So it's, you know, if somebody, for example, starts bragging about his hat size, he's a little premature, but there is a relationship. And there would almost have to be, because suppose you could get everything done with a brain that was much smaller, then people who had that brain would have a big advantage because they would need less energy to run it. And I'll tell you, birth would be a lot easier for a population like that. I mean, today, baby skulls are just about as big as mothers can stand. Birth is not a terribly easy process. If they shrank 20%, it'd be much easier. So if you could, if there was no payoff to a large brain, you'd expect them to be smaller. So that suggests there must be a payoff. And again, studies show that there is some.
So on the continuum of human evolution, maybe in 15 or 20,000 years, we might see a difference.
Well, we know that it's changed for sure. It's gone down in the last 15. If it goes down that much again, we'll be back down with Homo erectus. One suspects that might not be so good. But there have been other changes in between. And there's also been probably regional changes, depending on, you know, the local payoff, you know, the local expenses, that sort of thing. There's, you know, these trends, some of them are the same everywhere, some of them vary from place to place. It all depends on how the environment changes.
I'd like to go back and talk a little bit about where our species evolved in comparison to where the Neanderthals evolved. Where is it understood that the Neanderthals came from?
Well, if we go back far enough, at one point the two species were one.
In Central Africa?
Maybe East Central Africa, right. Although it's hard to be absolutely sure. See, we have a problem here. See, East Africa, which is the dry area, places like Kenya, Tanzania, up into Somalia and Ethiopia, we have a lot of human fossils. Most of our evidence of human evolution is in that area, and sometimes down to South Africa. Almost none of it is from the more tropical forested parts of Africa, and the reason is there are two reasons. One for sure, one maybe. One is that when you have the sort of soil made by those leaves falling, it's a little bit acid, and bones just melt away in it. There aren't any fossils in those areas, or very few. Now, does that prove there was nobody there? I said, well, we don't really know. I mean, for example, chimpanzees live in those forests, and we have almost no fossils of chimpanzees. I mean, but we have, like, I think recently we found a fossil with three chimpanzee teeth. I mean, if we looked at the fossil record, we wouldn't think there was such a thing as a chimpanzee. But so there might have been humans in some of those regions a long time ago, but we just don't know. But the part we know is in East Africa. Now then, starting about almost 2 million years ago, Homo erectus, which is getting more like modern humans, when they had a larger brain and they were using better tools, they moved out of Africa into Europe and Southern Asia. Well, first Southern Asia, then Europe. Europe was cold. Europe took a little longer. But the Neanderthals are, probably a later expansion than this. And the estimate is that their last common ancestry with modern humans was about 500,000 years ago. So, you know, they haven't been separate. They weren't separated from us forever. But they went up into Europe, which was a very different place, much colder. And they lived a different sort of life. They seem to have been very much hunters, depending very much on animal foods. We've been able to look at their bones, and we can determine that they're almost entirely carnivorous, somewhere between a wolf and a fox. And it seems likely that our ancestors ate more of a mixed diet, which is true of people like the Bushmen today. I mean, they hunt, but they also gather plants. But up in Ice Age Europe, I think the gathering plants didn't work too well. They hunted things, and they hunted bison, they hunted elk, or the called red deer in Europe, occasionally mammoths, which strikes me as pretty difficult to do. So we know something about their way of life. In fact, the funny thing is we know more about them than we do about our own ancestors at the same time because we have a lot more fossils. Europe was a good place for preserving fossils. Caves are a good place. And there's all these universities with full of professors that are not far from the old Neanderthal stomping grounds. So you have, you know, Frenchmen and Germans and so forth have been looking into this stuff. We have something like 200 Neanderthal skeletons, and we have actually many fewer of modern humans in Africa in the same time period, maybe only 20.
This edition of Radio Curious is the second of a two-part series with Gregory Cochran, author of The 1,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. You are listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Gregory Cochran, how did you get into this area of work from aerospace?
Oh, that's a strange story. I have this idea involving disease causation, and I happened to mention it once to this kid who was hanging some doors for us. He was a biology major down at University of New Mexico here, and he mentioned this to his professor, who thought those ideas were real interesting. I ended up talking to the professor after a while. Then finally I said, oh, suppose I should write this up. I wrote up an article. One of the reviewers was Paul Ewald, and we wrote some articles about, basically on some ideas I had about suppose you have a condition that's moderately common, let's say 1% or more, and it really drops fitness in an evolutionary sense, you know, drops people the number of offspring you have, and it's been around a long time. Myoglobinosis is almost certainly a consequence of some infectious disease. The thing is, if it was something else, you'd expect evolution to eventually fix it, make something not be such a problem. But with an infectious disease, evolution's playing on both sides. So the disease also has its own tendencies to, you know, if you get resistant, it tends to find a way around your resistance and so forth. So this applied to things, you know, it applied to all the big classic diseases we already knew about, things like, you know, tuberculosis and smallpox and malaria, but also applied to things that weren't so obvious, things like ulcers, which turned out to be caused by a germ in the stomach. And people had spent years, and it never occurred to anybody that it ought to be a germ. I said, if you think of this the right way, it had to be. So, you know, Paul and I ended up doing quite a bit of, we wrote several articles on things related to that idea. You know, certainly some conditions which nobody knew had a pathogen cause, we were arguing there was a good chance it did. And the other thing is, see, to the extent this is true, this is useful because it's easier to do something about a pathogen than it is, say, about genetics. Mm-hmm. We could maybe give you a shot or an antibiotic, but if it's you've just got genes of this sort, I said, there's not much we can do at this moment, maybe someday. Anyway, and then later, because I was sort of now involved in biology, I ended up running into Henry Harpending, essentially on the Internet. And eventually, we ended up writing some stuff together. Our first big thing was this Ashkenazi paper. It was just, I sort of stumbled repeatedly into this stuff, and a lot of it I was just saying, well, you know, according to the theory, this should happen. How come it doesn't? How come you guys are just accepted the fact that it doesn't when the theory says it should happen? Well, we're all used to it. I said, well, I'm not. There's a lot of things that they teach in anthropology, such that every human being's mind works in exactly the same way, and this couldn't possibly have changed. You look at it and says, why would that be true? I mean, generally somewhat similar, sure, but, you know, functionally exactly the same. Why? It doesn't look like it, and you look at the evolutionary theory, there's no reason it should be. There's reason to think that people's personality changed. You know, evolution has a single motto, whatever works.
Changes in people's personality, do you think that's due to a genetic evolutionary change or due to the circumstances of their life, what they have been exposed to?
Well, one thing it looks to me is that people who have lived in places where, like, you know, hunter-gatherers appear not to have had bosses, kings, chiefs, any of those things. And when people try, like in Among the Bushmen, somebody tries to explain why we all have to do what you say, they make merciless fun of him and they ignore him. But that didn't stay true when people started farming. There were ways in which people could assert authority in that new situation. I mean, really, ultimately, it boils down to you grow grain, they steal it, they pay the mercenaries with it. Well, and one thing I said in the book is I said, when people tried things like that in the Bushmen, you could just walk away, but you can't walk away from a farm. It's too valuable. Well, I think that people got more tamed. They changed in ways that made it easier for them to do what they were told.
The end of the Anasazi civilization, which lived about 700 years ago near the corners of what is now Arizona, New Mexico, Colorado, and Utah, is thought to have occurred when, for whatever reason, social or political, the people who lived there walked away from their homeland and dispersed.
Well, yeah, you see funny things like that in the American Indian civilizations. There's things where a civilization would fall, but nobody conquered it. And I'm thinking maybe they just got tired of it. I think there are differences. I mean, you know, people tried to enslave Indians, and they wouldn't do it. I mean, they just wouldn't cooperate. Some people do, some people don't. But if you're in a situation where you have to, well, then eventually the people who are left are the ones who do, at least occasionally. The phrase I used, I said, anybody whose ancestors have been farmers for a long time is descended from people who preferred to live on their knees than die on their feet. You know, he fought the law and the law won. I think that's one thing. I think there's probably been changes in IQ. I mean, no hunter-gatherer group scores real high. I think it's harder to be real aggressive in a situation where you run into lots of people. I think population density makes it harder to make that work. If you're somebody who, you know, starts a fight easily, you'll get killed. If you keep fighting with people constantly, right, which would happen if the population was dense.
Yeah, the chances are someone will get the best of you.
Right. I mean, if it's something that people are scarce, you only do this once in your life, well, maybe it'll work. Maybe you'll win something big. Maybe you'll win the girl of your dreams or something. But it can't be the right answer if you have to do it all the time.
Well, Gregory Cochrane, author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution, I want to thank you for being with us on this second part of our conversation, and again ask you our signature questions. Is there a new fact or idea or concept that you can share with us that you've learned recently?
Well, there have been a couple facts that along a certain trend that I've been interested in for years. Some work I used to do and still do occasionally with Paul Ewald on the evolution of infectious disease. We were predicting years ago that quite a few diseases would have subtle ways in which germs contributed to them or viruses that were not yet discovered. And there's been a couple in the last year that may fit into that. One, there's starting to be some evidence that a particular fairly common virus may be involved in the nastiest kind of brain cancer, glioblastoma, and that virus being cytomegalovirus, which is unfortunately in the news, for example, because Senator Kennedy has this. And I know more about it than I want to from friends. Anyhow, if this is the case, if this virus is involved in the cause of it, this could be a good thing for the future. We might be able to do something about preventing it. And that would be the fact that I find particularly interesting, because this is something I care about.
Tell us about an interesting book that you've read lately.
Yeah. Well, I haven't read this book completely, and I suspect it's going to take me about 2 or 3 years to finish it, because it's sort of overwhelming. But this is a new book called The Princeton Companion to Mathematics. And it's written by people, you know, by many people who are absolutely top-notch in their fields, people who have, you know, won the highest awards in mathematics, in many cases, the Fields Medal. And I once had a bachelor's in mathematics as well as in physics, and I used to think I knew some math. But this book is a good correction to realize how much there is to know, how little I ever learned, and how no human being's ever going to know all of it ever again. It just sort of shows the size and the power and the fascination of modern mathematics. No one would have to read all of it, but a lot of people would find something interesting in it.
Is there an author or a lead author in what sounds like a compilation?
Yeah, the editor is Timothy Gowers, G-O-W-E-R-S, who is himself, of course, a Fields Medalist, and it has many other people in here. The Princeton Companion to Mathematics, which is, I think, Princeton University Press.
Well, Gregory Cochrane, thank you very much for being with us on Radio Curious. Gregory Cochrane is the co-author of The 10,000-Year Explosion, How Civilization Accelerated Human Evolution. This program was the second of a two-part interview that was recorded on February 23, 2009, in conversation with Gregory Cochrane from his home in Albuquerque, New Mexico. The book that he recommends is The Princeton Companion to Mathematics by Timothy Gowers, June Barrow Green, and Imre Leder. Copies of this and other editions of Radio Curious can be found on our website, www.radiocurious.org. They're also available in CD format for $14 each. At Radio Curious, we appreciate your thoughts and ideas about our programming and enjoy hearing from you. Our address is Post Office Box 7, Ukiah, that's U-K-I-A-H, California, 95482. Our email address is curious@radiocurious.org, and the phone is 707-462-6541. You've been listening to Radio Curious. I'm Barry Vogel. Thank you for joining us.